The carving is finished. But the dragon is not completed. He looked around at us, watching him, and I could see how he struggled to make the words hold his meaning. I have put all I am into him, everything save enough to keep my heart beating and the breath flowing in my body. As has Kettle. That, too, we could give. But it would still not be enough. He walked forward slowly, to lean against his dragon. He pillowed his face on his thin arms. All about him, where his body rested against the stone, an aura of color rippled on the dragon's skin, turquoise edged with silver. The scales flashed uncertainly in the sunlight. I could feel the ebbing of his skill into the dragon. It seeped from Verity into the stone as ink soaks onto a page. King Verity, I said softly, warningly. With a groan, he stood free of his creation. Do not fear, Fitz. I will not let him take too much. I will not give up my life to him without reason. He lifted his head and looked around at us all. Strange, he said softly. I wonder if this is what it feels like to be forged. To be able to recall what one once felt, but unable to feel it any more. My loves, my fears, my sorrows. All have gone into the dragon. Nothing have I held back. Yet it is not enough. Not enough. My Lord Verity. Kettle's old voice was cracked. All hope had run out of it. You will have to take Fitz chivalry. There is no other way. Her eyes, once so shiny, looked like dry black pebbles as she looked at me. You offered it, she reminded me, all your life. I nodded my head. If you would not take my child, I added quietly. I drew a breath deep into my lungs. Life. Now. Now was all the life I had, all the time I could truly give up. My king, I no longer seek any bargain of any kind. If you must have my life so that the dragon may fly, I offer it. Verity swayed slightly where he stood. He stared at me. Almost you make me feel again. But, he lifted a silver finger and pointed it, accusingly, not at me, but at Kettle. His command was as solid as the stone of his dragon as he said, no. I have told you that, no. You will not speak of it to him again. I forbid it. Slowly, he sank down to his knees, then sat flat beside his dragon. Damn this Kerasid, he said in a low voice. It always leaves you just when you need its strength most. Damn stuff. You should rest now, I said stupidly. In reality, there was nothing else he could do. That was how Kerasid left one, empty and exhausted. I knew that only too well. Rest, he said bitterly, his voice failing on the word. Yes, rest. I shall be well rested when my brother's soldiers find me and cut my throat. Well rested when his coterie comes and tries to claim my dragon as their own. Make no mistake, Fitz, that is what they seek. It won't work, of course. At least I don't think it will. His mind was wandering now. Though it might, he said in the faintest of breaths. They were skill-linked to me for a time. It might be enough that they could kill me and take him. He smiled a ghastly smile. Regal as dragon. Do you think he will leave two stones of Buckkeep Castle atop each other? Behind him, Kettle had folded herself up, her face against her knees. I thought she wept, but when she slowly fell over onto her side, her face was lax and still. Her eyes closed. Dead. Or sleeping the exhausted sleep of the Karas seed. After what Verity had said to me, it scarcely seemed to matter. My king stretched himself out on the bare, gritty pedestal. He slept beside his dragon. Ketrikin went and sat down beside him. She bowed her head to her knees and wept, not quietly. The rending sobs that shook her should have roused even the dragon of stone. They did not. I looked at her. I did not go to her. I did not touch her. I knew it would have been of no use. Instead, I looked to the fool. We should bring blankets and make them more comfortable, I said helplessly.
Ah, of course. What better task for the White Prophet and his catalyst?
He linked arms with me. His touch renewed the thread of skill bond between us. Bitterness. Bitterness flowed through him. With his blood, the six duchies would fall. The world would end. We went to fetch blankets. 38. Verity's bargain. When all the records are compared, it becomes plain that no more than 20 red ships actually ventured inland as far as Terlake, and only 12 proceeded past Terlake to menace the villages adjoining Tradeford. The minstrels would have us believe there were scores of ships and literally hundreds of raiders upon their decks. In song, the banks of the Buck and Vin rivers were red with flames and blood that summer. They are not to be faulted for this. The misery and terror of those days should never be forgotten. If a minstrel must embroider the truth to help us recall it fully, then let her, and let no one say she has lied. Truth is often much larger than facts. Starling came back with the fool that evening. No one asked her why she no longer kept watch. No one even suggested that perhaps we should flee the quarry before Regal's troops cornered us there. We would stay, and we would stand, and we would fight. To defend a stone dragon. And we would die. That went without saying, quite literally. It was knowledge that none of us uttered. When Ketrikin had fallen asleep, exhausted, I carried her down to the tent she had shared with Verity. I laid her down on her blankets and covered her well. I stooped and kissed her lined forehead as if I were kissing my sleeping child. It was a farewell, of sorts. Better to do things now, I had decided. Now was all I had for certain. As dusk fell, Starling and the fool sat by the fire. She played her harp, softly, wordlessly, and looked into the flames. A bared knife lay on the ground beside her. I stood a time, and watched how the firelight touched her face. Starling birdsong, the last minstrel to the last true Farseer king and queen. She would write no song that anyone would recall. The fool sat still and listened. They had found a friendship of sorts. I thought to myself, if this is the last night she can play, he can give her no finer thing than that, to listen well, and let her music lull him with her skill. I left them standing there and took up a full waterskin. Slowly I climbed the ramp up to the dragon. Night Eyes followed me. Earlier, I had built a fire on the dais. Now I fed it from what remained of Ketrikin's firewood, and then sat down beside it. Verity and Kettle slept on. Once Chade had used Karas seed for 2 days straight. When he collapsed, he had taken most of a week to recover. All he had wanted to do was sleep and drink water. I doubted that either would awaken soon. It was all right. There was nothing left to say to them anyway. So I simply sat beside Verity and kept watch over my king. I was a poor watchman. I came awake to his whispering my name. I sat up instantly and reached for the water skin I had brought with me.
"My king,"
I said quietly. But Verity was not sprawled on the stone, weak and helpless. He stood over me. He made a sign to me to rise and follow him. I did, moving as quietly as he did. At the base of the dragon's dais, he turned to me. Without a word, I offered him the water skin. He drank half of what it held, paused a bit, and then drank the rest. When he was finished, he handed it back to me. He cleared his throat.
"There is a way, Fitzchivalry."
His dark eyes, so like my own, met mine squarely.
"You are the way,
so full of life and hungers, so torn with passions."
"I know,"
I said. The words came out bravely. I was more frightened than I had ever been in my life. Regal had scared me badly in his dungeon, but that had been pain. This was death. I suddenly knew the difference. My traitorous hands twisted the front hem of my tunic.
"You will not like it,"
he warned me. "I do not like it, but I see no other way. I am ready." I lied. "Only, I should like to see Molly once more, to know that she and Nettle are safe. And Burridge." He peered at me. "I recall the bargain you offered, that I would not take Nettle for the throne." He glanced away from me. "What I ask of you will be worse. Your actual life. All the life and energy of your body. I have spent all my passions, you see. I have nothing left. If I could but kindle in myself one more night of feelings, if I could recall what it was to desire a woman, to hold the woman I loved in my arms." His voice dwindled away from me.
"It shames me to ask it of you. Shames me more than when I drew strength from you, when you were no more than an unsuspecting boy."
He met my eyes again, and I knew how he struggled to use his words. Imperfect words.
"But you see even that. The shame I feel, the pain that I do this to you, even that is what you gave me. Even that I can put into the dragon."
He looked away from me.
"The dragon must fly, Fitz. He must.
Verity. My king." He stared away from me.
"My friend."
His eyes came back to mine.
"It is all right.
But I should like to see Molly again. Even briefly.
It is dangerous. I think what I did to Carad woke true fear in them. They have not tried their strength against us since then, only their cunning, but please."
I said the small word quietly.
Verity sighed. "Very well, boy. But my heart misgives me."
Not a touch. He didn't even take a breath, even as Verity dwindled. That was the power of his skill. We were there, with them. I sensed Verity retreating, giving me the illusion I was there alone. It was an inn-room, clean and well-furnished. A branch of candles burned beside a loaf of bread and a bowl of apples on a table. Burridge lay shirtless on his side of the bed. Blood had clotted thickly about the knife wound and soaked the waist of his breeches. His chest moved in the slow, deep rhythms of sleep. He was curled around Nettle. She was snugged against him, deeply asleep, his right arm over her protectively. As I watched, Molly leaned over them and deftly slid the babe from under Burridge's arm. Nettle did not stir as she was carried over to a basket in the corner and tucked into the blankets that lined it. Her small pink mouth worked with memories of warm milk. Her brow was smooth beneath her sleek black hair. She seemed none the worse for everything she had endured. Molly moved efficiently about the room. She poured water into a basin and took up a folded cloth. She returned to crouch beside Burridge's bed. She set the basin of water on the floor beside the bed and dipped the rag into it. She wrung it out well. As she set it to his back, he jerked away with a gasp. Fast as a striking snake, he had caught her wrist.
Burridge, let go. This has to be cleaned.
Molly was annoyed with him.
Oh, it's you.
His voice was thick with relief. He released her.
Of course it's me. Who else would you expect?
She sponged at the knife wound gently, then dipped the rag in the water again. Both the rag in her hand and the basin of water beside her were tinged with blood. His hand groped carefully over the bed beside him.
What have you done with my baby?
He asked.
Your baby is fine. She's asleep in a basket right there.
She wiped his back again, then nodded to herself.
The bleeding has stopped, and it looks clean. I think the leather of your tunic stopped most of her thrust. If you sit up, I can bandage it.
Slowly, Burridge moved to sit up. He gave one tiny gasp, but when he was sitting up, he grinned at her. He pushed a straggle of hair back from his face.
Whitby's,
he said admiringly. He shook his head at her. I could tell it was not the first time he had said it.
It was all I could think of,
Molly pointed out. She could not keep from smiling back.
It worked, did it not?
Wondrously,
he conceded.
But how did you know they'd go after the red-bearded one?
That was what persuaded them,
and damn near persuaded me as well.
She shook her head to herself.
It was luck. And the light. He had the candles and stood before the hearth. The hut was dim. Bees are drawn to light. Almost like moths are.
I wonder if they are still inside the hut.
He grinned as he watched her rise to take away the bloody rag and water.
I lost my bees,
she reminded him sadly.
We will go burning for more.
Burridge comforted her. She shook her head sadly.
A hive that has worked the whole summer makes the most honey.
At a table in the corner, she took up a roll of clean linen bandaging and a pot of unguent. She sniffed at it thoughtfully.
It doesn't smell like what you make, she observed.
It will probably work all the same,
he said. A frown creased his brow as he looked slowly around the room.
Molly, how are we to pay for all this?
I've taken care of it.
She kept her back to him.
How?
He asked suspiciously. When she looked back at him, her mouth was flat. I'd known better than to argue with that face.
Fitz's pin. I showed it to the innkeeper to get this room, and while you both slept this afternoon, I took it to a jeweler and sold it.
He had opened his mouth, but she gave him no chance to speak.
I know how to bargain, and I got its full worth.
Its worth was more than coins. Nettle should have had that pin,
Burridge said. His mouth was as flat as hers.
Nettle needed a warm bed and porridge far more than she needed a silver pin with a ruby in it. Even Fitz would have had the wisdom to know that.
Oddly enough, I did. But Burridge only said,
I shall have to work many days to earn it back for her.
Molly took up the bandages. She did not meet his eyes.
You are a stubborn man, and I am sure you will do as you please about that,
she said. Burridge was silent. I could almost see him trying to decide if that meant he had won the argument. She came back to the bed. She sat beside him on the bed to smear the ointment on his back. He clenched his jaws but made no sound. Then she came to crouch in front of him.
Lift your arm so I can wrap this,
she commanded him. He took a breath and lifted his arm up and away from his body. She worked efficiently, unrolling the bandaging as she wrapped it around him. She tied it over his belly.
Better?
She asked.
Much.
He started to stretch, then thought better of it.
There's food,
she offered as she went to the table.
In a moment. I saw his look darken. So did Molly. She turned back to him, her mouth gone small. Molly. He sighed. He tried again. Nettle is King Shrewd's great-grandchild. A farseer. Regal sees her as a threat to him. He may try to kill you again, both of you. In fact, I'm sure he will.
He scratched at his beard. Into her silence he suggested,
"Perhaps the only way to protect you both is to put you under the true king's protection. There is a man I know. Perhaps Fitz told you of him. Chade?"
She shook her head mutely. Her eyes were going blacker and blacker.
"He could take Nettle to a safe place and see you were well provided for."
The words came out of him slowly, reluctantly. Molly's reply was swift. "No, she is not a farseer. She is mine, and I will not sell her, not for coin or safety." She glared at him and practically spat the words. "How could you think I would?" He smiled at her in anger. I saw guilty relief on his face.
"I did not think you would, but I felt obliged to offer it."
His next words came even more hesitantly.
"I had thought of another way. I do not know what you will think of it. We will still have to travel away from here, find a town where we are not known."
He looked at the floor abruptly.
"If we were wed, before we got there, folk would never question that she was mine."
Molly stood as still as if turned to stone. The silence stretched. Burrich lifted his eyes and met hers pleadingly.
"Do not take this wrong. I expect nothing of you that way, but even so, you need not wed me. There are witness stones in Kevdor. We could go there with a minstrel. I could stand before them and swear she was mine. No one would ever question it."
"You'd lie before a witness stone?"
Molly asked incredulously.
"You'd do that? To keep Nettle safe?"
He nodded slowly. His eyes never left her face. She shook her head.
"No, Burrich. I will not have it. It is the worst of luck to do such a thing. All know the tales of what become of those who profane the witness stones with a lie."
"I will chance it."
He spoke grimly. I had never known the man to lie before Nettle had come into his life. Now he offered to give a false oath. I wondered if Molly knew what he was offering her. She did.
"No.
You will not lie." She spoke with certainty.
"Molly, please."
"Be quiet,"
she said with great finality. She cocked her head and looked at him, puzzling something out.
"Burrich,"
she asked with a tentative note to her voice,
"I have heard it told. Lacey said that once you loved Patience."
She took a breath.
"Do you love her still?"
she asked.
Burrich looked almost angry.
Molly met his stare with a pleading look until Burrich looked away from her. She could barely hear his words.
"I love my memories of her as she was then, as I was then. Probably much as you still love Fitz."
It was Molly's turn to wince.
"Some of the things I remember, yes."
She nodded, as if reminding herself of something. Then she looked up and met Burrich's eyes.
"But he is dead."
So oddly final, those words coming from her. Then, with a plea in her voice, she added,
"Listen to me. Just listen. All my life it's been, first my father. He always told me he loved me, but when he struck me and cursed me, it never felt like love to me. Then Fitz,
He swore he loved me and touched me gently. But his lies never sounded like love to me. Now you, Burridge, you never speak to me of love. You have never touched me, not in anger nor desire. But both your silence and your look speak more of love to me than ever their words or touches did. She waited. He did not speak.
Burridge?
She asked desperately.
You are young,
he said softly,
and lovely. So full of spirit, you deserve better.
Burridge, do you love me?
A simple question, timidly asked. He folded his work-scarred hands on his lap.
Yes.
He gripped his hands together to stop their trembling. Molly's smile broke forth, like the sun from a cloud.
Then you shall marry me, and afterward, if you wish, I shall stand before the witness stones, and I will admit to all that I was with you before we were wed, and I will show them the child.
He finally lifted his eyes to hers. His look was incredulous.
You'd marry me, as I am, old, poor, scarred?
You are none of those things to me. To me, you are the man I love.
He shook his head. Her answer had only baffled him more.
And after what you just said about bad luck, you would stand before a witness stone and lie?
She smiled a different sort of smile at him. One I had not seen in a long time. One that broke my heart.
It need not be a lie.
She pointed out, quietly. His nostrils flared like a stallion's as he surged to his feet. The breath he drew swelled his chest.
Wait,
she commanded him softly. And he did. She licked her thumb and forefinger. She swiftly pinched out all but one candle. Then she crossed the darkened room to his arms. I fled.
Oh, my boy, I am so sorry.
I shook my head silently. My eyes were squeezed tight shut, but tears leaked from them anyway. I found my voice.
He will be good to her.
And Nettle.
He is the sort of man she deserves. No, Verity. I should take comfort in it. To know he will be with her, caring for them both.
Comfort. I could find no comfort in it. Only pain. It seems a very poor bargain I have made you. Verity sounded genuinely grieved for me.
No, it's all right.
I caught my breath. Now, Verity, I would it were done quickly.
Are you sure?
As you will. He took my life from me. It was a dream I had had before. I knew the feel of an old man's body. The other time I had been King Shrewd, in a soft nightshirt, in a clean bed. This time was harsher. I ached in every joint of my body. My gut burned inside me, and I had scalded myself on my face and hands. There was more pain than life left in this body, like a candle almost burned to the socket. I opened my eyes stickily. I sprawled on cold, gritty stone. A wolf sat watching me.
This is wrong,
he told me. I could think of nothing to say to that. It certainly did not feel right. After a time, I pushed myself up to my hands and knees. My hands hurt. My knees hurt. Every joint in my body creaked and complained as I drew myself up and looked around. The night was warm, but I still shivered. Above me, on a dais, an incomplete dragon slumbered.
I do not understand.
Night Eyes pleaded for an explanation.
I do not wish to understand. I do not want to know.
But whether I wished it or not, I did know. I walked slowly, and the wolf came at my heels. We walked past a dying fire between two tents. No one kept watch. From Ketrikin's tent there were small noises. Verity's face was what she saw in the dimness, Verity's dark eyes looking into hers. She believed her husband had finally come to her. In truth, he had. I did not want to hear, I did not want to know. I walked on with my old man's careful pacing. Great black blocks of stone loomed around us. Ahead of us, something clicked and chinked softly. I walked through the sharp-edged stone shadows and into moonlight again.
Once you shared my body, is it like that?
No.
I spoke the word aloud, and in the wake of my voice I heard a small scrabbling.
What's that?
I'll go and see.
The wolf melted into the shadows. He returned instantly.
It's only the scentless one. He hides from you. He does not know you.
I knew where I would find him. I took my time. This body had all it could do to move, let alone move swiftly. When I came to Girl on a Dragon, it was horribly hard to clamber up on her dais. Once I was up, I could see the fresh rock chips everywhere. I sat down by the dragon's feet, a cautious lowering of my body to cold stone. I looked at his work. He had almost cut her free.
Fool!
I called out softly in the night. He came slowly, from the shadows, to stand eyes down before me.
My king,
he said softly.
I tried, but I cannot help myself. I cannot just leave her here.
I nodded slowly, wordlessly. At the base of the dais, night eyes whined. The fool glanced down at him, then back up at me. Puzzlement crossed his face.
My lord?
He asked. I reached for the thread of skill bond between us and found it. The fool's face grew very still as he struggled to understand. He came to sit beside me. He stared at me, as if he could see through Verity's skin.
I like this knot,
he said at last.
Nor I.
I agreed.
Why have you...
Better not to know,
I said briefly. For a time we sat in silence. Then the fool reached back to brush a handful of fresh stone chips from about the dragon's foot. He met my eyes, but there was still furtiveness, as he drew a chisel from his shirt. His hammer was a stone.
That's Verity's chisel.
I know. He doesn't need it any more, and my knife broke.
He set the edge carefully to the rock.
It works much better anyway.
I watched him tap another small chip free. I aligned my thoughts with his.
She draws on your strength,
I observed quietly.
I know.
Another chip came free.
I was curious, and my touch hurt her.
He placed his chisel again.
I feel I owe her something.
Fool.
She could take all you offer her, and it would still not be enough.
How do you know?
I shrugged.
This body knows.
Then I stared as he laid his skill fingers to the place where he had chiseled. I winced, but sensed no pain from her. She took something from him, but he had not the skill to shape her with his hands. What he gave her was only enough to torment her.
She reminds me of my older sister, he said into the night. She had golden hair.
I sat in stunned silence. He did not look at me as he added,
I should have liked to see her again. She used to spoil me outrageously. I would have liked to have seen all my family again.
His tone was no more than wistful as he moved his fingers idly against the chiseled stone.
Fool. Let me try.
He gave me a look that was almost jealous.
She may not accept you.
He warned me. I smiled at him. Verity's smile. Through his beard.
There is a link between us, fine as thread, and neither the elf bark nor your weariness aid it. But it is there, put your hand to my shoulder."
I did not know why I did it. Perhaps he had never before spoken to me of a sister or a home he missed. I refused to stop and wonder. Not thinking was so much easier, and not feeling was easiest of all. He put his unskilled hand, not to my shoulder, but to the side of my neck. Instinctively he was right. Skin to skin I knew him better. I held Verity's silver hands up before my eyes, and marveled at them. Silver to the eye, scaled and raw to the senses. Then, before I could change my mind, I reached down and grasped the dragon's shapeless forefoot between my two hands. Instantly I could feel the dragon. Almost it squirmed within the stone. I knew the edge of each scale, the tip of each wicked claw, and I knew the woman who had carved it. The women. A coterie so long ago. Salt's coterie. But Salt had been too proud. Her features were on the carven face, and she had sought to remain in her own form, carving herself upon the dragon that her coterie shaped around her. They had been too loyal to object, and almost she had succeeded. The dragon had been finished and almost filled. The dragon had quickened and began to rise as the coterie was absorbed into it. But Salt had striven to remain only within the carved girl. She had held back from the dragon, and the dragon had fallen before it could even rise, sinking back into the stone, miring down forever, leaving the coterie trapped in the dragon and Salt trapped in the girl. All this I knew, swifter than lightning. I felt, too, the hunger of the dragon. It pulled at me, pleading for sustenance. Much had it taken from the fool. I sensed what he had given, light and dark, the jeering taunts of gardeners and chamberlains, when he was young at Buckkeep. A branch of apple blossoms outside a window in spring. An image of me, my jerkin flapping as I hurried across the yard at Burridge's heels, trying to make my shorter legs match his long stride. A silver fish, leaping above a silent pond. At dawn. The dragon tugged at me insistently. I suddenly knew what had really drawn me here. Take my memories of my mother, and the feelings that went with them. I do not want to know them at all. Take the ache in my throat when I think of Molly. Take all the sharp-edged, bright-colored days I recall with her. Take their brilliance and leave me but the shadows of what I saw and felt. Let me recall them without cutting myself on their sharpness. Take my days and nights in Regal's dungeons. It is enough to know what was done to me. Take it to keep, and let me stop feeling my face against that stone floor, hearing the sound of my nose breaking, smelling and tasting my own blood. Take my hurt, that I never knew my father. Take my hours of staring up at his portrait, when the great hall was empty and I could do so alone. Take my...
Fitz, stop! You give her too much. There will be nothing left of you.
The fool's voice inside me was horror-stricken at what he had encouraged. Memories of that tower-top, of the bare windswept Queen's Garden and Galen standing over me. Take that image of Molly going so willingly to Burridge's arms. Take it and quench it and seal it away where it can never sear me again. Take...
My brother. Enough.
Night-Eyes was suddenly between me and the dragon. I knew I still gripped that scaly foreleg, but he snarled at it, defying it to take more of me. "I do not care if it all is taken," I told Night-Eyes.
"But I do. I would sooner not be bonded with a forged one. Get back, cold one."
He snarled in spirit as well as beside me. To my surprise, the dragon yielded. My companion nipped at my shoulder.
"Let go. Get away from that."
I let go of the dragon's foreleg. I opened my eyes, surprised to find it was still night all around me. The fool had his arm around Night-Eyes.
"Fitz,"
he said quietly. He spoke into the wolf's ruff, but I heard him clearly.
"Fitz, I am sorry, but you cannot throw away all your pain. If you stop feeling pain..."
I did not listen to the rest of what he said. I stared at the dragon's foreleg. Where my two hands had rested against the lumpy stone, there were two handprints now. Within those shapes, each scale stood fine and perfect. All of that, I thought, all of that, and this is how much dragon it brought me. Then I thought of Verity's dragon. It was immense. How had he done it? What had he held inside him all those years to have enough for the shaping of such a dragon?
He feels much, your uncle. Great loves, vast loyalty. Sometimes I think that my 200-odd years pale beside what he has felt in his 40-some.
All three of us turned to Kettle. I felt no surprise. I had known she was coming, and I had not cared. She leaned heavily on a stick, and her face seemed to hang from the bones of her skull. She met my eyes, and I knew that she knew everything. Skill-linked as she was to Verity, she knew it all.
"Get down from there, all of you, before you hurt yourselves."
We obeyed slowly, and I slowest of all. Verity's joints ached, and his body was weary. Kettle looked at me balefully when I finally stood beside her.
"If you were going to do that, you might have put it in Verity's dragon instead,"
she pointed out.
"He wouldn't let me. You wouldn't let me."
"No, we wouldn't have. Let me tell you something, Fitz. You are going to miss what you gave away. You will recover some of the feelings in time, of course. All memories are connected, and like a man's skin, they can heal. In time, left to themselves, those memories would have stopped hurting you. You may some day wish you could call up that pain."
"I do not think so,"
I said calmly to cover my own doubt.
"I still have plenty of pain left."
Kettle lifted her old face to the night. She drew a long breath in through her nose.
"Dawn comes,"
she said, as if she had scented it.
"You must return to the dragon, to Verity's dragon. And you two..."
Her head swiveled to regard the fool and Night-Eyes.
"You two should go up to that lookout point and see if Regal's troops are in sight yet. Night-Eyes, you let Fitz know what you see. Go on, both of you, and fool, you leave girl on a dragon alone after this. You would have to give her your entire life, and even then it might not be enough. That being so, stop torturing yourself and her. Go on now!"
They went, but not without some backward looks.
"Come on,"
Kettle ordered me tersely. She began to hobble back, the way she had come. I followed, walking as stiffly as she, through the black and silver shadows of the blocks that littered the quarry. She looked every bit of her 200-odd years. I felt even older. Aching body, joints that caught and creaked. I lifted my hand and scratched my ear. Then I snatched it down, chagrined. Verity would have a silver ear now. Already the skin of it burned, and it seemed the distant night insects chirred more loudly now.
"I am sorry, by the way, about your Molly girl and all. I did try to tell you."
Kettle did not sound sorry. But I understood that now. Almost all of her feelings were in the dragon. She spoke of what she knew she would have felt. Once. She still had pain for me, but she no longer recalled any pain of her own to compare it with. I only asked quietly,
"Is there nothing private anymore?"
"Only the things we keep from ourselves,"
she replied sadly. She looked over at me.
"It is a good thing you do this night, a kind thing."
Her lips started to smile, but her eyes teared.
"To give him one last night of youth and passion."
She studied me, the set look on my face.
"I shall say no more of it, then."
I walked the rest of the way beside her in silence. I sat by the warm embers of last night's fire and watched the dawn come. The shrilling of night insects changed gradually to the morning challenges of distant birds. I could hear them very well now. It was strange, I thought, to sit and wait for myself. Kettle said nothing. She breathed deep of the changing scent of the air as night turned to dawn, and watched the lightening of the sky with avid eyes, storing it all up, to put into the dragon. I heard the grate of boot against stone and looked up. I watched myself coming. My stride was confident and brisk, my head up. My face was freshly washed, my wet hair slicked back from my brow into a warrior's tail. Verity wore my body well. Our eyes met in the early light. I saw my eyes narrow as Verity appraised his own body. I stood up and, without thinking, began to brush my clothes off. Then I realized what I was doing. This was not a shirt I had borrowed. My laugh boomed out, louder than I used it. Verity shook my head at me.
"Leave it, boy. There's no making it better. And I'm almost finished with it anyway."
He slapped my chest with the palm of my hand.
"Once I had a body like this,"
he told me, as if I hadn't known.
"I had forgotten so much of how that felt, so much."
The smile faded from his face as he regarded me, peering at him from his own eyes. A wave of giddiness, black, closed from the edges of my vision, and I folded up my knees and sank down to keep from falling.
"Sorry,"
Verity said quietly, and it was in his own voice. I looked up to find him looking down on me. I stared at him mutely. I could smell Ketrickin's scent on my skin. My body was very tired. I knew a moment of total outrage. Then it crested and fell away as if the emotion were too much effort. Verity's eyes met mine, and accepted all I felt.
"I will neither apologize to you nor thank you. Neither would be adequate."
He shook his head to himself.
"And in truth, how could I say I am sorry? I am not."
He looked away from me, out over my head.
"My dragon will rise. My queen will bear a child.
I will drive the red ships from our shore." He took a deep breath.
"No. I am not sorry for our bargain."
His eyes came back to me.
"Fitzchivalry, are you sorry?"
Slowly I stood up. "I don't know." I tried to decide. "The roots of it go too deep," I said at last. "Where would I start to undo my past? How far back would I have to reach? How much would I have to change in order to change this? Or to say I was not sorry now?"
"The road is empty below us,"
Night Eyes spoke in my mind.
"I know. Kettle knows too. She but looked for something to busy the fool and sent you along to keep him safe. You can come back now." "Oh, are you all right?"
"Fitzchivalry, are you all right?"
There was concern in Verity's voice, but it could not completely mask the triumph there as well.
"Of course not,"
I told them both. "Of course not." I walked away from the dragon. Behind me, I heard Kettle ask eagerly,
"Are we ready to quicken him?"
Verity's soft voice carried to my ears.
"No, not just yet.
For a little while longer I would have these memories to myself. For a short time more I would remain a man." As I passed through the camp, Ketrickin emerged from her tent. She wore the same travel tunic and leggings she had the day before. Her hair was caught back from her face in a short, thick braid. There were still lines in her brow and at the corners of her mouth, but her face had the warm luminescence of the finest pearls. Renewed faith shone in her. She took a deep breath of the morning air and smiled at me radiantly. I hurried past her. The stream water was very cold. Coarse horsetail grasses grew along one bank. I used handfuls of them to scrub myself. My wet clothes were draped on the bushes on the other side of the stream. The heat of the day promised they would soon be dry. Night Eyes sat on the bank and watched me with a pucker between his eyes.
"I do not understand. You do not smell bad."
"Night Eyes, go hunting, please. You wish to be alone?
As much as that is possible any more. He stood up and stretched, curtsying low to me as he did so.
Some day it will be only you and I. We shall hunt and eat and sleep, and you will heal.
May we both live to see that. I agreed wholeheartedly. The wolf slipped through the trees. Experimentally, I scrubbed at the fool's fingertips on my wrist. They did not come off, but I learned a great deal about the life cycle of a horsetail fern. I gave it up. I decided I could take my entire skin off and still not feel free of what had happened. I waded out of the stream, dashing the water off myself as I went. My clothing was dry enough to put back on. I sat down on the bank to put my boots on. I nearly thought of Molly and Burridge, but I quickly pushed the image away. Instead, I wondered how soon Regal's soldiers would arrive, and if Verity would have his dragon finished before then. Perhaps it was even now finished. I should want to see it. I wanted more to be alone. I lay back on the grass and looked up into the blue sky overhead. I tried to feel something. Dread. Excitement. Anger. Hate. Love. Instead, I felt only confused. And tired. Weary of flesh and spirit. I closed my eyes against the brightness of the sky. The harp notes walked alongside the sounds of the stream flowing. They blended with it, then danced apart. I opened my eyes to it and squinted at Starling. She sat on the stream bank beside me and played. Her hair was down, drying in ripples down her back in the sun. She had a stem of green grass in her mouth, and her bare feet nestled against the soft grass. She met my eyes but said nothing. I watched her hands play on the strings. Her left hand worked harder, compensating for the stiffness of the last two fingers. I should have felt something about that. I didn't know what. What good are feelings? I didn't know I had the question until I spoke it aloud. Her fingers poised over the strings. She furrowed her brow at me.
I don't think there's an answer to that question.
I'm not finding answers to much of anything lately. Why aren't you back in the quarry watching them complete the dragon? Surely that is the stuff for a song to spring from.
Because I'm here with you, she said simply.
Then she grinned.
And because everyone else seems busy.
Kettle sleeps. Ketrickin and Verity.
She was combing his hair when I left. I do not think I had seen King Verity smile before. When he does, he looks a great deal like you, about the eyes. Anyway, I do not think they will miss me.
And the fool? She shook her head.
He chips at the stone around girl on a dragon. I know he should not, but I do not think he can stop. Nor do I know any way to force him.
I don't think he can help her. But I don't think he can resist trying. For all his quick tongue, he has a soft nature.
I know that.
Now.
In some ways I've come to know him very well. In others, he will always be unknowable to me.
I nodded silently to that. The silence lasted a time. Then, suddenly it became a different kind of silence.
Actually,
Starling said uncomfortably,
the fool suggested I should find you.
I groaned. I wondered just how much he had told her.
I'm sorry to hear about Molly,
she began. But not surprised. I filled in for her. I lifted my arm and put it across my eyes to block the sunlight.
No,
she spoke quietly.
Not surprised.
She cast about for something to say.
At least you know she is safe and cared for,
she offered. I knew that. It shamed me that I could find so little comfort in it. Putting it into the dragon had helped in the same way that cutting off an infected limb helped. Being rid of it was not the same as being healed of it. The empty place inside me itched. Perhaps I wanted to hurt.
I watched her from the shade of my arm.
Fitz,
she said quietly, I asked you once for yourself, in gentleness and friendship, to chase a memory away. She looked away from me, at the sunlight glinting on the stream. Now I offer that, she said humbly. But I don't love you, I said honestly, and instantly knew that it was the worst thing I could have said just then. Starling sighed, and set her harp aside.
I know that. You know that.
But it was not a thing that had to be said just now. And I know that. Now. It is just that I don't want any lies, spoken or unspoken. She leaned over me and stopped my mouth with hers. After a time she lifted her face a little.
I am a minstrel. I know more about lying than you will ever discover. And minstrels know that, sometimes, lies are what a man needs most, in order to make a new truth of them.
Starling, I began.
You know you will just say the wrong thing,
she told me.
So why don't you be quiet for a time? Don't make this complicated. Stop thinking just for a while.
Actually, it was quite a while. When I awoke, she lay there warm against my side. Night Eyes stood over us, looking down at me, panting with the heat of the day. When I opened my eyes, he folded his ears back and gave his tail a slow wag. A drop of warm saliva fell on my arm.
Go away. The others are calling for you and looking for you.
He cocked his head at me and offered, I could show Ketrickin where to find you. I sat up and squashed three mosquitoes on my chest. They left bloody smears. I reached for my shirt. Is something wrong?
No. They are ready to wake the dragon. Verity wishes to tell you goodbye.
I shook Starling gently.
Wake up.
Or you will miss Verity waking the dragon. She stirred lazily.
For that I shall get up. I can think of nothing else that would stir me. Besides, it may be my last chance at a song.
Fate has ruled that I always be elsewhere whenever you do something interesting. I had to smile at that. So, you will make no songs about chivalry's bastard after all? I teased her.
One, perhaps. A love song?
She gave me a last, secret smile.
That part, at least, was interesting.
I stood up and drew her to her feet. I kissed her. Night Eyes whined his impatience, and she turned quickly in my arms. Night Eyes stretched and bowed low to her. When she turned back to me, her eyes were wide. I warned you, I told her. She only laughed and stooped to gather up our clothes. 39. Verity's Dragon. Six Duchy's troops poured into Blue Lake and took ship for the farther side of the Mountain Kingdom on the very days that the Red Ships were beating their way up the Vin River to Tradeford. Tradeford had never been a fortified city, although word of the ships coming preceded them by fast messenger. The news was greeted with general disdain. What menace were 12 ships of barbarians to such a great city as Tradeford? The city guard was alerted, and some of the dockside merchants took steps to remove their goods from warehouses close to the water. But the general attitude was that, if they did manage to get as far up the river as Tradeford, archers would easily pick off the raiders before they could do any real damage. The general consensus was that the ships must be bringing some offer of treaty to the King of the Six Duchies. There was much discussion as to how much of the coastal duchies they would ask ceded to them, and the possible value of reopening trade with the out-islands themselves, not to mention restoring the trade flow down the Buck River. This is but one more example of the errors that can be made when one thinks one knows what the enemy desires and acts upon it. The folk of Tradeford ascribed to the Red Ships the same desire for prosperity and plenty that they themselves felt. To base their estimation of the Red Ships on that motive was a grievous mistake.
I don't think Ketrickin had accepted the idea that Verity must die for the dragon to quicken until the actual moment he kissed her goodbye. He kissed her so carefully, his hands and arms held wide of her, his head cocked, so that no silver smear would touch her face. For all that, it was a tender kiss, a hungry and lingering one. A moment longer she clung to him. Then he said something softly to her. She immediately put her hands to her lower belly. "How can you be so sure?" she asked him, even as the tears began to course down her cheeks. "I know," he said firmly. "And so my first task must be to return you to Jompe. You must be kept safe this time."
"My place is at Buckkeep Castle," she protested.
I had thought he would argue, but you are right. It is, and thither I shall bear you. Farewell, my love." Ketrickin did not reply. She stood watching him walk away from her, an intense look of incomprehension on her face. For all the days we had spent striving for this very thing, at the end it seemed rushed and untidy. Kettle paced stiffly by the dragon. She had bid us all farewell with a distracted air. Now she hovered beside the dragon, breathing as if she had just run a race. At every moment she was touching the dragon, a fingertip caress, a dragging hand. Color rippled in the wake of her touch and lingered, fading slowly. Verity took more care with his goodbyes. To Starling he admonished, "Care for my lady. Sing your songs well and true, and let no man ever doubt the child she carries is mine. With that truth I charge you, minstrel."
"I shall do my best, my king,"
Starling replied gravely. She went to stand beside Ketrickin. She was to accompany the queen on the dragon's broad back. She kept wiping her damp palms down the front of her tunic and checking to make sure the pack that carried her harp was secure to her back. She gave me a nervous smile. Neither of us needed more farewell than that. There had been some furor about my decision to stay. Regal's troops draw nearer with every passing moment. Verity reminded me yet again.
"Then you should hurry, so I will not be in this quarry when they arrive,"
I reminded him. He frowned at that. "If I see any of Regal's troops upon the road, I shall see they do not get this far." He offered me. "Take no risks with my queen," I reminded him. Night Eyes was my excuse to stay. He had no wish to ride upon the dragon. I would not leave him. I am sure Verity knew the real reasons. I did not think I should return to Buck. I had already made Starling promise me that there would be no mention of me in song. It had not been an easy promise to wring from a minstrel, but I had insisted. I never wanted either Burridge or Molly to know that I yet lived.
"In this, dear friend, you have been sacrifice,"
Ketrickin told me quietly. She could offer me no greater compliment. I knew no word of me would ever pass her lips. The fool was the one who was being difficult. All of us urged him to go with the queen and the minstrel. He consistently refused.
"The White Prophet will stay with the Catalyst,"
was all he would say. I privately believed it was more a case of the fool staying with girl on a dragon. He had become obsessed with her, and it frightened me. He would have to leave her before Regal's troops arrived at the quarry. I had privately told him that, and he had nodded easily, but with a distracted look. I doubted not that he had plans of his own. We had run out of time to argue with him. There came a time when there was no reason left for Verity to linger. We had said little to one another, but I felt there was little we could say. Everything that had happened now seemed inevitable to me. It was as the fool said. Looking back, I could see where his prophecies had long ago swept us into this channel. No one could be blamed. No one could be blameless. He gave me a nod before he turned and walked toward the dragon. Then he halted suddenly. As he turned back, he was unbuckling his battered sword belt. He came toward me, wrapping the belt loosely about the sheath as he came.
"Take my sword," he said abruptly. "I won't need it. And you seem to have lost the last one I gave you."
He halted suddenly in mid-stride, as if reconsidering. He hastily drew the sword from the sheath. One last time he ran a silver hand down the blade, leaving it gleaming behind his touch. His voice was gruff as he said,
"It would be a poor courtesy to Hod's skill to pass this on with a blunted blade. Take better care of it than I did, Fitz."
He resheathed it and handed it to me. His eyes met mine as I took it.
"And take better care of yourself than I did. I did love you, you know," he said brusquely, "despite all I've done to you. I loved you."
At first I could think of no answer to that. Then, as he reached his dragon and placed his hand on its brow, I told him, "I never doubted it. Never doubt I loved you. I don't think I shall ever forget that final smile over his shoulder." His eyes went a last time to his queen. He pressed his hands firmly to the dragon's chiseled head. He watched her as he went. For an instant, I could smell Ketrikin's skin, recall the taste of her mouth on mine, the smooth warmth of her bare shoulders gripped in my hands. Then the faint memory was gone, and Verity was gone, and Kettle was gone. To my wit and my skill, they disappeared as completely as if they had been forged. For an unnerving instant, I saw Verity's empty body. Then he flowed into the dragon. Kettle had been leaning on the statue's shoulder. She was gone faster than Verity, spreading out across the scales as turquoise and silver. Color flooded the creature and suffused him. No one breathed, save that Night Eyes keened softly. A great stillness held under the summer sun. I heard Ketrikin give a single, choked sob. Then, like a sudden wind, the great scaled body drew air into its lungs. His eyes, when he opened them, were black and shining, the eyes of a far-seer, and I knew Verity looked out of them. He lifted his great head upon his sinuous neck. He stretched like a cat, bowing and rolling reptilian shoulders and spreading claws. As he drew his clawed feet back, his talons scored the black stone deeply. Suddenly, like a sail catching the wind, his immense wings unfurled. He rattled them, a hawk settling his plumage, and refolded them sleek to his body. His tail gave a single lash, stirring rock dust and grit into the air. The great head turned, his eyes demanding we be as pleased with this new self as he was. Verity, as dragon, strode forward to present himself to his queen. The head he bent to her dwarfed her. I saw her whole reflection in one gleaming black eye. Then he dipped a shoulder to her, bidding her mount. For one instant, grief controlled her face. Then Ketrikin drew a breath and became queen. Fearlessly she strode forward. She placed her hand on Verity's shining blue shoulder. His scales were slick, and she slipped a trifle as she clambered to his back and then crawled forward to where she could straddle his neck. Starling gave me a look of terror and amazement, and followed the queen more slowly.
I saw her take her place behind Ketrigan and check once more that her harp pack was secured to her back. Ketrigan lifted an arm in farewell to us. She shouted something, but the words were lost to me in the wind of the dragon's opening wings. Once, twice, thrice he flapped them, as if getting the feel of them. Rock dust and grit flew stingingly against my face, and Night Eyes pressed close against my leg. The dragon crouched as he gathered his great legs under him. The wide turquoise wings beat again, and he sprang up suddenly. It was not a graceful launch, and he wobbled a bit as he took flight. I saw Starling clutch desperately at Ketrigan, but Ketrigan leaned forward against his neck, shouting her encouragement. In four beats, his wings carried him half the length of the quarry. He lifted, circling over the hills and trees that surrounded the quarry. I saw him dip his wings and turn to inspect the skill road that led to the quarry. Then his wings began to beat steadily, carrying him higher and higher. His belly was a bluish white, like a lizard's. I squinted to see him against the summer sky. Then, like a blue and silver arrow, he was gone, speeding toward Buck. Long after he was gone from sight, I stared after him. I let out my breath, finally. I was trembling. I wiped my eyes on my sleeve and turned toward the fool, who was gone.
Night Eyes, where is the fool?
We both know where he is gone. There is no need to shout. I knew he was right, yet I could not deny the urgency I felt. I ran down the ramp of stone, leaving the empty dais behind me.
Fool!
I cried as I reached the tent. I even paused to look inside, hoping that he might be packing up what we'd need to take with us. I don't know why I indulged such a foolish hope. Night Eyes had not waited. When I reached Girl on a Dragon, he was already there. He was sitting patiently, tail neatly coiled about his feet, looking up at the fool. I slowed when I saw him. My premonition of danger faded. He was sitting on the edge of the dais, feet dangling, head leaned back against the dragon's leg. The surface of the dais was littered with fresh chips from this day's efforts. I walked toward him. His eyes were lifted to the sky, and the expression on his face was wistful. Contrasted against the dragon's rich green hide, the fool was white no longer, but the palest of golds. There was even a tawny edge to his silky fine hair. The eyes, he turned to me, were pale topaz. He very slowly shook his head at me, but he did not speak until I leaned against her pedestal.
I had been hoping. I could not help hoping. But I have seen today what must be put into a dragon so it can fly.
He shook his head more forcefully.
And even if I had the skill to give it, I do not have it to give. Even were she to consume all of me, it would not be enough.
I did not say that I knew that. I did not even say that I had suspected it all along. I had finally learned something from Starling Birdsong. I let him have a silence. For a time. Then I said, Night Eyes and I are going to go get two Jeppers. When I come back, we had better pack swiftly and be gone. I did not see Verity give chase to anything. Perhaps that means Regal's troops are still far away, but I don't want to take any chances. He drew a deep breath.
That is wise. It is time for this fool to be wise. When you come back, I shall help you pack.
I realized then I was still gripping Verity's sword in its sheath. I took off the plain short sword and replaced it with the blade Hod had made for Verity. It weighed strangely against me. I offered the short sword to the fool. Want this? He glanced at me, a puzzled look.
What for? I'm a fool, not a killer. I've never even learned to use one.
I left him there to say his farewells. As we wended our way out of the quarry and toward the woods where we had been pasturing the Jeppers, the wolf lifted his nose and snuffed. Nothing left of Carrot but a bad smell, he noted, as we passed the vicinity of the body. I suppose I should have buried him.
I said as much to myself as him.
No sense in burying meat that is already rotten,
he noted with puzzlement.
I passed the black pillar, but not without a small shudder. I found our straying jeppers on a hillside meadow. They were more reluctant to be caught than I had expected.
Night Eyes enjoyed rounding them up considerably more than they or I did. I chose the lead jepper and one other. But as I led them away, the others decided to trail along after us as well.
I should have expected it. I had rather hoped the rest would stay and go wild. I did not relish the idea of six jeppers at my heel all the way back to Jampe. A new thought came to me as I led them past the pillar and into the quarry. I did not have to return to Jampe.
The hunting here is as good as any we've found.
We've the fool to think of, as well as ourselves.
I would not let him go hungry.
And when winter comes?
When winter comes, then... he is attacked.
Night Eyes did not wait for me. He streaked past me, grey and low, claws scratching against the black stone of the quarry floor as he ran. I let go of my jeppers and ran after him. The wolf's nose told me of human scent in the air. An instant later, he had identified Burl, even as he hurtled toward them. The fool had not left Girl on a Dragon. That was where Burl had found him. He must have come quietly, for the fool was never easy to take unawares. Perhaps his obsession had betrayed him. Whatever the case, Burl had got the first cut in. Blood ran down the fool's arm and dripped from his fingertips. He had left smears of it, all up the dragon as he climbed her. Now he clung, feet braced against the girl's shoulder, and one hand gripping the dragon's gaping lower jaw. In his free hand he gripped his knife. He stared down at Burl balefully, waiting. Skill boiled from Burl, angry and frustrated. Burl had climbed up onto the dais, and was seeking to clamber up the dragon itself now as he strove to reach up and impose a skill touch on the fool. The smoothly scaled hide was defying him. Only one as agile as the fool could have shimmied up to the perch where he clung just out of Burl's reach. Burl drew his sword in frustration and swung it at the fool's braced feet. Its tip missed, but not by much, and its blade rang against the girl's back. The fool cried out as loudly as if the blade had bit truly, and sought to scrabble higher. I saw his hand slip where his own blood had greased the dragon's hide. Then he was sliding down, scrabbling frantically as he came down hard, right behind the girl's seat on the dragon's back. I saw his head bounce glancingly against her shoulder. He looked half-stunned, and clung to where he was. Burl lifted his sword for a second swing, one that could easily separate the fool's leg from his body. Instead, soundless as hate could be, the wolf surged up onto the dais and took Burl from behind. I was still running toward them as I saw Night Eye's impact drive Burl forward to smack against Girl on a Dragon. He sank to his knees against the statue. His sword blow missed the fool and rang again against the dragon's gleaming green hide. Ripples of color raced away from that clash of metal against stone, like the ripples made when one tosses a pebble in a still pond. I reached the dais as Night Eyes darted his head in. His jaws closed, gripping Burl from behind, between his shoulder and neck. Burl screamed, his voice going amazingly shrill. He dropped his sword and lifted his hands to clutch at the wolf's ravening jaws. Night Eyes worried him like a rabbit. Then the wolf braced his front feet on Burl's wide back and made more sure of his grip. Some things happened too swiftly to tell well. I felt Will behind me at the same moment that the wild spattering of Burl's blood became a sudden gushing. Night Eyes had severed the great vein of his throat, and Burl's life was pumping out in jumping gouts of scarlet.
for you, my brother.
Night Eyes told the fool,
this kill for you.
Night Eyes still did not let go, but shook him again. The blood leaped like a fountain as Burl struggled, not knowing he was already dead. The blood struck the dragon's gleaming hide and ran down it to puddle in the chiseled troughs the fool had made, attempting to free his feet and tail. And there the blood bubbled and steamed, eating into the stone as scalding water would have eaten into a chunk of ice. The scales and claws of the dragon's hind feet were unveiled, the detail of the whip-like tail exposed, and as Night Eyes finally flung down Burl's lifeless body, the dragon's wings opened. Girl on a dragon soared up into the sky, as she had strained to do for so long. It seemed an effortless lifting, almost as if she floated away. The fool was borne away with her. I saw him lean forward, clutching instinctively at the supple waist of the girl before him. His face was turned away from me. I glimpsed the bland eyes and still mouth of the girl's face. Perhaps her eyes saw, but she was no more separate from the dragon than its tail or wing, merely another appendage, one to which the fool clung as they rose higher and higher. I saw all these things, but not because I stood and stared. I saw them in glimpses and through the wolf's eyes. My own gaze I turned on Will as he ran up behind me. He carried a bared blade in his hand and ran easily. I drew Verity's sword as I turned, and found it took no longer coming out of its sheath than the sword short I had become accustomed to. The strength of Will's skill hit me in a buffeting wave just as the tip of Verity's blade came free of the scabbard. I staggered back a step and threw up my walls against him. He knew me well. That first wave had been compounded not just of fear, but of specific pains. They had been prepared especially for me. I knew again the shock of my broken nose. I felt the burn of my split face, even if it did not stream hot blood down my chest as it once had. For a frozen heartbeat, all I could do was hold my walls against that crippling pain. The sword I gripped seemed suddenly made of lead. It sagged in my hand, its tip drooping toward the earth. Burl's death saved me. In the moment that Night Eyes flung his lifeless body down, I saw that death lap against Will. His eyes sagged almost shut with the impact of it. The last member of his coterie was gone. I felt Will diminish abruptly, not just as Burl's skill no longer supplemented his own, but as grief washed over him. I found in my mind an image of Carad's rotting body, and flung that at him for good measure. He staggered back. "You've failed, Will!" I spat the words. Verity's dragon has already risen. Even now it wings toward Buck. His queen rides with him, and she bears within her his heir. The rightful king will reclaim his throne and crown. He will scourge his coasts of red ships and scour Regal's troops from the mountains.